Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It's not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Matthew 20. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and, kneeling down, asked a favor of him. What is it you want? He asked. She said, grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom. You don't know what you're asking, Jesus said to them. Can you drink the cup I am going to drink? We can, they answered. Jesus said to them, you will indeed drink from my cup, but to sit at my right or my left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those to whom they have been prepared by my Father. When the ten heard about this, they were indignant with the two brothers. Jesus called them together and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. As Jesus and his disciples were leaving Jericho, a large crowd followed him. Two blind men were sitting by the roadside, and when they heard that Jesus was going by, they shouted, Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us. The crowd rebuked them and told them to be quiet, but they shouted all the louder, Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us. Jesus stopped and called them. What do you want me to do for you? He asked. Lord, they answered, we want our sight. Jesus had compassion on them and touched their eyes. Immediately they received their sight and followed him. Well, good afternoon. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I don't know if you saw it, there was quite a fun documentary on Michael Creek did it on Channel 4, Boris versus Dave. It wasn't exclusively about Brexit at all. It was mainly about them and their two and their backgrounds. And, of course, it's a lovely comparison to make. It's just quite fun as a documentary. Two men, two prominent politicians, same school, same university, entered Parliament the same year. And now, obviously, they were on opposing sides of the EU debate. And, of course, the guts of it really was what drives these men. And actually, well, that's quite fun in the media. How serious is their sort of tension and rivalry? Well, there was no shortage. Did anyone see it? No, you're quite... well, I can tell you anything, could I just make it up? Well, what happened was they got them in a boxing ring and with inflate, it was like it's a knockout. No, they didn't do that. They had a whole number of talking heads analysing this. One of them, Isabel Oakeshott, was the most interesting. You may know her. She wrote the unauthorised biography of David Cameron, which it's the un at the beginning, tells you all you need to know slightly about it. But anyway, describe their relationship like this. Oh yes, always warm, but always rivalrous. And yet completely now broken by Boris's decision to go for the out campaign. So she quoted one colleague in the cabinet. I've seen them looking at one another and sensed Boris thinking, Dave's taller, he's better looking. He always says the right thing. It annoys me. But there are times when Cameron looks at Boris and thinks, good grief, the man's a magician. In a million years, no matter how hard I work, there's no way I'd be able to produce that sort of stardust. And that was the gist of it. So the documentary is to be believed. Boris actually reckons himself 100 times cleverer than Dave, and on it goes. No, it's quite a good media story. And amidst the very serious implications for what's going on in the country, here's the sort of pantomime that sells newspapers, and we quite like that. But there is very obviously envy, rivalry, and not much love, as it's described in our little reading here today. Just that first little verse, 1 Corinthians 13, love is patient, love is kind. It does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud. That's love. Paul here says love is concerned with, if you put it in these terms, if you're operating a spotlight, getting a big spotlight and putting it on others. I want you to do well. I want to serve you. I want to see you flourish. Whereas the opposite, envy, boasting, gets the spotlight and puts it on me. Everyone look at me. And I don't care about you, I care about me. And, oh, I do care about you because you can be useful to me. It's which direction you want to focus the spotlight. On others? Love is concerned with others. Whereas the Corinthians were concerned with themselves. Now, we're spending a ludicrous amount of time just in one chapter of the Bible, 1 Corinthians 13, it's not ludicrous, but we're spending a bit of time then looking at this chapter of the Bible. We've said before, the Corinthian church, probably the most gifted or talented that Paul had planted, the Apostle Paul, they are an amazingly talented bunch, all sorts of gifts and abilities. But in this letter of 1 Corinthians, Paul will tell them that they're jealous, chapter 3, proud, chapter 4, arrogant, chapter 4, boastful, chapter 5, puffed up, chapter 8, self-seeking in chapter 10, humiliate others, chapter 11. So when he says here, love doesn't envy, it's very pointed. He's saying love doesn't envy and you do. Love doesn't boast and you do. Love is not proud and you are. Love does not look down on others, but you do. So it reads beautifully. It is beautiful, but it's a stinging rebuke to the people there. We said last time we looked at this, this little list, 15 descriptions or applications of love, just in verses 4 to 7, probably about a third of them deal with forbearance, patience, keeping going. About a third in that whole area. About a third deal with the issue of pride. And then there's some other things. So it's pride, really, that concerns us today. I want to define one or two of these terms, and then we'll illustrate them or see how Jesus handles them in Matthew 20. So let me put it this way. Humans fight for status. Jesus serves others. And we want to shout out for mercy. First then, humans fight for status. If you read this letter, particularly these chapters 12, 13, 14, it's very obvious that in Corinth is a church, and indeed a city, but a church where everyone, well, they're slightly competing. Who's most important? What's he doing in church today? Well, as long as I'm doing more, as long as people talk about me and what I did, it's all about me for the people in Corinth. And so there's envy. Chapter 13, verse 4, love doesn't envy. If I was to try and distinguish between envy and boast, I guess it's this. Envy is a response to the success of others, whereas boasting is a response to success of me. So envy, I'm looking at what others are doing, what others have got. Boasting, I'm just purely concerned with me and promoting me. I think that's probably the difference. Envy. Now there's a gentle sense of envy, I guess. Oh, I wish I had his talent. Just gently, idly wishing it. I wish I had that shirt. That's a nice shirt. I wish I had his hair, I'd like a little bit more. This is all gentle, you don't do much about it. You can't sort of whip someone else's hair off and put it on your own head. Well, I guess you can, but that's a bit odd. There's a gentle sense. But here the word that gets used, zelos, it's a sort of sense of burning with envy. Love doesn't burn with envy, isn't consumed by it. It's not just here the sense of, oh, I'd like what he's got, but I want what he's got. And I want him to lose it. So you get a classic example, it seems to be in the Bible, famous story of Solomon. Solomon, when two women in 1 Kings chapter 3, two women come before Solomon. And they both have babies, but one of them has died in the night. And both women are saying that the child who lives, it's mine. It's mine. Her child died. That one's mine. It's mine. And so they both come before Solomon and say, it's my baby. It's my baby. And so he says, well, I'll tell you what we'll do then. We'll just chop the baby in half with a sword and give you half each. And the woman who isn't the mother says, yeah, that's fine. But the one who's genuinely the birth mother says, no, don't do that. Just give it to her. And Solomon says, well, that's the mom, isn't it? But what's happened there? The one who's lost her child is envious. She doesn't just say, I want a baby. She says, I don't want her to have it. I'll kill the baby rather than let her have it. That is a burning with envy. You're in a pretty bleak place if you get that far down the road with envy. But I guess the question in more simple terms is this. How do you feel when someone of your peers or someone of equal or even less ability to you succeeds above you. How do you feel about that? Is it a, oh, well, that would have been nice for me, but, or is it a bit more? Is it a bit pointed? Is it a bit personal? I cannot believe that David has got that deal, got that promotion, whoever it may be. Okay, that's envy. Boasting's a bit different again. As I say, it's more personal. Boasting. I loved it. I love this definition. I've never read this before. Someone put it in these terms. Boasting is our own private advertising business, our own PR campaign to publicise an image of ourselves. I thought it was terrific. Boasting. It's just our own private advertising business. I don't know if anyone here works directly in PR, but as far as I could tell from those I know at church, you are in the PR business. It goes a little bit like this. The whole point of what they're doing is to project a favourable image of their clients. So if you're in financial PR and the quarterly results come in, and whoever it is, you know, I represent, I don't know, Kraft Foods. Look at our success. Look at the growth. Look at our growth across all sectors this year in this quarter. And it's trumpeted around and the emails go out. If you have a really bad quarter, you just bury it. You don't project. Do you know what? This quarter we've done terribly. Our stock's gone down 20%. You just bury it. And you look for sort of excuses. You say, well, of course the stock's gone down 20%, but you need to look at the mitigating circumstances. You know, yes, our stock's gone down, but not as bad as his. Not as bad as theirs over there. So that's PR, isn't it? You sort of puff everything that goes vaguely well, and anything that goes badly you find excuses for, so you don't upset the market. That's your job. I mean, I could do the job, I reckon. Six figures, I'm yours. Not true. But that's what we do personally. Things go well. And so we proclaim it. In the 21st century, we love to proclaim it on Facebook. This is my latest triumph. And here's me on holiday. And here's the view from my bedroom. And isn't it magnificent? Or here's what I'm eating right now. It just drives me nuts when people do that. So it's just, look at how successful I am. Look at the extraordinary things I'm doing. But what if things go badly? Lose a job. Something happens at work, you get exposed as not truthful. No one blogs that. No one puts that on their Facebook. Hey, had an awful day today. My boss exposed my fraud. No one puts that up, do they? There's mitigating. So I didn't quite tell the truth, but you need to understand that's just how things operate. And I'm still more truthful than him. He's the worst of the liars. It's just mitigating circumstances, just PR. For ourselves. Love doesn't envy, doesn't boast. Right, this other little one. Love doesn't dishonour others. That is, viewing people as useful or not. If someone's useful to me, well, I'll be polite to them. If there is someone who they're nothing to me. They offer me nothing. They can encourage me in no way. They can't help me in any way, so I just ignore them. Love doesn't do that. I was struck, it was a couple of weeks ago, I went to visit a guy, a Christian guy, he's a senior partner in a law firm, and just went to have lunch with him. But it was very striking he came and collected me. And he's exceptional level of courtesy to everyone, to the cleaner that we passed, to the doorman, knew all their names, knew their wife's names. They're nothing to him, really. They're not going to help him. They can't offer him anything to productively push him any further up the company or win business or win cases. But it doesn't matter to him, because he would never dishonour anyone. Because love's not like that. No sense of self-importance. No sense of asserting his status. But actually, I thought that's very, very lovely. Very impressive, perhaps. So that's what we're talking about. Love doesn't envy, doesn't boast, isn't proud, doesn't dishonour others. Now let's look at how Jesus unpacks this a little bit. We've only got brief time. But Matthew chapter 20 is really a fight for status. So let's look at this. Two groups then. First of all, you get the sons of Zebedee. They're asking for prominence. Well, actually, it's not quite that true, is it? It's the mother of Zebedee's sons. It's always a little bit embarrassing when you have to send your mum into the office. Can my son have a promotion, please? That's a slightly embarrassing place to be, you'd imagine. But verse 20, the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and, kneeling down, asked a favour of him. What is it you want, he asked. She said this, grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right hand, the other at your left hand in your kingdom. Can the spotlight be on them, please, Jesus? Can it be on us? Say, James and John here. What about us? Sorry, James and Peter. What about us? Can we just push ourselves, assert ourselves forward? Well, Jesus asks them, look, verse 22, you do not know what you're asking. Jesus said to them, can you drink the cup I'm going to drink? Oh, yes, we can, they answered. Jesus said, you will indeed drink the cup, but to sit at my right hand or left is not for me to grant. Now, the cup he's talking about, anyone who's read the Old Testament should know. It's repeatedly the cup of God's wrath, the cup of God's judgment. Jeremiah 22, Isaiah 51, the most prominent places. So Jesus is saying, oh, you want to be on my right hand and left hand? Can you endure God's judgment upon a cross to pay for the mistakes, the sin, the selfishness of the world? Can you do that? Oh, yeah, we could do that. We could do that. Yeah, well, that's fine. We've sort of been around with you. We've knocked around with you for a year, so we've learnt one or two things. So, yeah, about saving the world, yeah, we're up for that. We can do that. No, you can't. What are you talking about? You're talking nonsense. But that's pride, isn't it? Just, oh, yeah, we'll have a go. We'll have a go at that. Proud self-confidence, boasting. So they're in this game. But secondly, then you get the rest, the other 10, verse 24. When the 10 heard about this, they were indignant with the two brothers. What? What? I mean, they don't mind Jesus sitting on a throne. He's the boss. But their peers, the guys, why would you get up seats? Why are you and not me? That's what winds them up. And that's true of all of us. Again, it's not people who are distant from us that we envy, but our peers getting success, our peers being recognised, why them and not me? If you're a young musician trying to get a place in a London orchestra, fiercely competitive, if you're a young musician, you don't envy Sir Simon Rattle. He's not the person you sort of covet. You know, he's whatever he's the greatest English musician, I don't know. Certainly the one with the best self-promotion. But anyway, you don't envy Simon Rattle. But if one of your peers, one of your generation, gets a job at the London Symphony Orchestra, London Philharmonic, whatever, why him? My bow work's just as good as his bow work. My fingers tinkle, whatever that means, I don't know what that means. But, you know, I'm just as good as him. Why's she got it? Why's she got it? I bet it's what she wore. That's why she got the job, and I didn't. You know, it's what? We can deal with the distance to the guy at the top. Or, you know, more precisely, you're a junior surveyor in a firm. You generally don't envy the managing partner. You look at it, well, that was a stressful job, or, you know, anyway, don't know how he does all that. You don't envy but just your peers who are promoted first, they're the ones we dislike. They're the ones we get it. It's always the same. That's how envy, competitiveness, it's how it functions. The temptation's always to envy those of a similar age and stage. Oh, they've got a... How come they've got a nicer house? How come they've got much better holidays than me? They've got a larger family than me. That's what gets to us. Oscar Wilde, from a slightly different perspective, but memorably, good with words, put it this way, anybody can sympathise with the sufferings of a friend, but it requires a very fine nature to sympathise with a friend's success. A friend, that is someone you know well, someone on the same level with you. They have a disaster, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, I'm genuinely sorry for you. But someone on the same sort of vintage as you does phenomenally well. It's far harder to say, oh, I'm really pleased for you. I'm really pleased for you. It's slightly how it emotionally feels. Humans fight for status. That's how it is. The disciples, they're full of that. Jostling. Who's going to be... right hand, left. Jesus is very different. So humans fight for status. Jesus, by contrast, serves others. Let me read from verse 25. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many." There is one of Jesus' bluntest statements of self-understanding. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Now, we're familiar with the concept of ransom. Someone is kidnapped. Someone is enslaved. But a price, the ransom price, is paid to free them from their captivity. To free them. So they're free again. Well, what Jesus, of course, is talking about here is that all of humanity is enslaved to sin, to death. And Jesus pays the ransom price. He dies. He takes the punishment of God. He pays for all we've done wrong, so we're free to have a relationship with God again. Jesus didn't envy, didn't boast, wasn't proud. Jesus came, he didn't live for himself, he came and lived for others. And he says, look, that's where greatness is found. Greatness is found in looking to the needs of others and serving them, rather than being preoccupied with your own status. It's a striking little picture he gives, isn't it? The rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. That's what they do. Not so with you. He says here, look, greatness is not found, it's not found in dining at the fine restaurants with the white tablecloths. Greatness is, in one sense, found serving at the tables. Not literally, not You're a great one if you go and get a job downstairs at one of the restaurants in Shepherd's Market. But greatness is found in serving. And yet it's so instinctive to us as humans. Greatness is found for us, we think, in being served. Having people wait upon us. That's what we like, naturally. Because we're desperately, desperately, desperately trying to assert our status. It's why we envy, it's why we boast, it's why we're rude, it's why we're proud. Jesus says, no. Greatness is found in serving. One of the men I've been most impressed with at church over the years was a man, I'll call him Dan. He was quite a senior guy in a multinational company. He ran their London office. It turned over about $4 billion a year by the end of his time in London. But the thing I loved about him is he was always deflected. Actually, it took me about a year to work out really what he did, properly what he did. I just do some insurance stuff. The fact that he ran this office, their London office, which dominated Europe, turned over, was their key office in Europe, was managing a staff of hundreds. No one knew, because when you saw him at church, he was always shifting the chairs, always cleaning up the coffee cups, always in the kitchen washing up. You would never know who this man was and his place in the pecking order in his company. Never boasting, never proud. He got this. It was very impressive. So lastly, what do you do to move in this direction? How do you become someone who is less envious, less boastful, less proud, and more willing to love others, more willing to put the spotlight on others rather than yourself? Well, that's why these two blind men are here, to show us the way. And quite simply, they shout for mercy. Verse 29, as Jesus and his disciples were leaving Jericho, a large crowd followed them. Two men were sitting by the roadside. When they heard that Jesus was going by, they shouted, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us." The crowd rebuked them and told them to be quiet, but they shouted all the louder, "Lord, Son of God, David, have mercy on us." Striking, these guys are saying, "Have mercy." The crowd, "Shh, will you shut up?" But they're jumping around like Nigel Farage in the European Parliament. Did you see him today? It was very unpleasant. Not like that. But they just won't be told to shut up. They won't be. They just keep on shouting and keep on shouting. Eventually, Jesus asks them this question. Verse 32. "What do you want me to do for you?" Actually, grammatically, it's identical to the question in verse 21 that the sons of Zebedee are asked. What is it you want? Jesus asks the disciples, two of them, what do you want? We want to be great, please, if that's all right. He asks these two men, what do you want? Mercy. Very different. We just want our basic need met. We're not interested in status. We're not interested in ruling. Not interested in being promoted above the other 10. We just want the most basic of needs met. We want to see. We want mercy. And the reason they point the way is this. If you've got a problem, and you know you've got a problem, you want that fixed, and the rest of your issues can go hang. Well, let me put it in this terms. If a man goes to hospital in an ambulance in chronic pain. Now he's a multimillionaire. He has got 20 children and 500 grandchildren. He's very enormously successful. He's had perfect health all his life, but he's just in chronic pain. He's got an MBE. He's got a knighthood. He's got all these things. But he's pulled into A&E in chronic pain. What he does not do is sit there or stand there and say, can I just tell you about all I've achieved in my life? Can I tell you about my rewards? Can I tell you about the money I've earned? Can I show you all the photos of my children and grandchildren? Can I show them all? He does not. All he does is shout out, get me a doctor! Take away the pain! That's all he's concerned about. The fact that he's achieved so much, he's worth so much, he just couldn't care less. He just wants his basic need met. And Jesus is saying the same here. Look, if you know you have a moral problem, if you know you have a problem before God, because, well, you're not the person you think. You are a person who boasts, who envies, who's proud, who looks down on others. It's sin. Another way the Bible would call it. If you know you've got a problem, you say, Jesus, can you deal with my problem? Can you pay for everything I've done wrong? Can you ransom me out of the slavery I am to this pattern of life? You do that. You don't boast. The man who knows or the woman who knows they have a moral problem doesn't boast or envy others. They just look to Jesus and say, can you help? Can you help me, please? Or if you're a Christian, you've done that. And you look back and say, thank you for helping me. That help was more important than anything else in this life. So in the end, there's a couple of ways you go with this. If you do not recognize, here's the first. If you do not recognize or you forget you have a need for mercy, that the fundamental need of your life is for forgiveness from God. If you forget that, neglect that, then you may well start to think, I am something. I have achieved quite a lot. And I'm going to tell the world about it and boast. Or I've achieved quite a lot, but not as much as her. And that just needles away at me. You'll be like that. You're bound to be envious of the stuff others have got or boast of what you've got. If you forget that your most basic need is for forgiveness and mercy, but if you remember it, secondly, if you remember it, the thing I need more than anything in this world is mercy, forgiveness for how I've lived. And if you're a Christian and I've received it, well, I've got what I need more than anything else. And Lord, I can go to you and say, yeah, I'm self-absorbed, I'm jealous, I'm proud, I'm envious, that's how I am. But you've dealt with the cost of those things. And can you help me change? Be less like that? And that's how you move in this direction. To love like Jesus loves. Verse 4, 1 Corinthians 13. Love is patient, love is kind. It does not envy, it is not does not, it is not proud. Let me lead us in prayer. Father God, any of us who are honest know that there are times when we envy what others have got and what we lack. There are times when we boast of our own achievements. But would you move us to be those who love like you do? We want the spotlight to be not upon ourselves, but upon others. And so would you help us recognize and dwell upon rightly and celebrate the way you meet our greatest need in Jesus. Amen.